Hi, I'm Anna Burt, and I'm Sue's daughter.
Hi, I'm Emily Benita. I'm Trudy's daughter.
Though our mums are both dead, the fact doesn't change. We're both adapting to living our lives without our mums. And no, we are very much not the only ones. We have joined forces to create a podcast in the hope that we can provide what we feel we needed and still need in our grief.
The mothership, the mother load. There's no getting around that mother means something big. There are so many different kinds of mother, biological, step, figure, and so many different kinds of grief when they're gone. We're here to do what we can in podcast form, welcoming guests so we can explore our experiences together, where they converge and where they vary, and, hopefully, understand a little more about the nuance and scope of
the mother of all losses.
Anna, dearest Anna, because I'm going to stop calling you by your full name, how is your grief today?
I've had a breakthrough in therapy this week, Emily.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is a very millennial moment. So I recently was seeing someone for a while, and they really let me down. And they won't, I don't even think they listen, but if they do, beep, you really let me down. But we've just had a conversation and that's okay. And the reason they let me down was because they shocked me, and they shouldn't have shocked me. And I was talking to my therapist about this, and I was saying, look, it's not the end of the world. You know, it wasn't the big love of my life, whatever. It was that I was shocked by something that they did. And I realized that I cannot cope with shock, and that shock is really linked to my trauma, and the trauma of losing my mum, and my mum being ill after ill after ill. And amputation is like very shocking, and she was amputee and then amputee again and then terminally ill. And then, I mean, her death obviously wasn't a shock. For me, it wasn't a shock. But I just basically realised that I can pretty much cope with anything as long as it doesn't surprise me. And it really made me think about her and the way that she died and the way that she really allowed me in. She allowed me in so that I wasn't shocked. And I don't think I really realised the value of not shocking people until really this week. And my therapist was just like, yeah, I mean, shout out to Claire if you're ever listening. It was basically just like, yeah, that's your trauma. And that is why you don't want to be shocked, because of the shock that you've been through before. Like, I've spoken about it before, like, I don't like getting phone calls out the blue from my dad, because I think someone's, I'm better at that now, but like, it's definitely like a trigger for me. And I realised that actually I can understand anything as long as someone doesn't surprise me. And that comes from my grief. But then also, I've been feeling a little bit sorry for myself. And there were times when I was like, I really need my mum to tell me to get a grip. But actually, now I feel like I've got a grip myself and I feel much better. Actually, after reading a little bit of our guest's wonderful book, which is about I'm going to call it the fertile void. My friend Emma Jane Unser told me about this. The fertile void of breakups, and how there's this gap. And then, like, suddenly every single second of my time is my time again. And I'm like, oh, I can do anything I want. And now I'm kind of feeling good and pumped. So my grief was a bit up and down. It was a bit choppy, to use our water analogy. But I've had a good and productive week. And I feel like I'm on the way up to just continuing to be fabulous.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. First of all, congratulations on your breakthrough, because I think we don't really appreciate how fucking like satisfying those are. I think it's Japanese, a term called satori, which is like, it literally means like a poke in the eye, but it's a term for enlightenment in the way that it's kind of like, oh, fuck, ah. But like that pain actually allows you to like see incredibly clearly. And I love that. And it sounds like a little bit of what you've been through recently.
I've been satori'd.
Yeah, full blown satori, mate. And I think, oh God, just self-knowledge, right? Because self-knowledge isn't knowing absolutely everything about yourself. It's knowing where you are in the moment and how that links up to how you've been and how you will be. And honestly, like the way that I behaved in relationships.
Oh, it's terrible. I just feel like now I don't have the guilt that I used to have in relationships, because I feel like from every single one I've learned and I've taken something from it, I've always tried to be a better person in them. And actually, I didn't fuck it up this time. This was not a me thing. And I'm smug about it.
You're allowed to be. You should be. Like, I think that's great.
How is your grief, then?
My grief, Anna, thank you for asking, because I'm always so grateful to be asked. For the benefit of the listener, it's been a little while since we've recorded. So I'm just like, ah, seeing you. My grief is, can't really use the water analogy, can I? It's sort of on the surface, but in a good way, and I'll tell you for why. So towards the end of last year, end of October, beginning of November, I started to slip into another episode of depression, which I've spoken to you, Anna, a little bit about, obviously off podcast. And I've had it for as long as I can remember, officially diagnosed when I was 13. But I haven't been aware of having an episode in the run-up to or since Trude's died. Like, all my whole system was just full of fear and then grief and understanding. Oh, that's so different from depression. I didn't feel, I was just consumed with that, obviously. And it's not to say that I don't still have that, of course not. But I think once the rawness had subsided and I'm starting to get to that point where it's not like as close and open every day, it was like, oh, hello, that thing that I have and have done my whole life. And so this was the first time where I had to factor in the decision whether to go on medication or not, or how to manage my depression. It's the first time I had to factor grief into it and to like have a conversation with myself and be like, are you sure you're not just because like you really loved her, remember, and still do, and that's shit that she's gone. And I was like, yeah, no, this is something different. Like, and it's like the trying to tell the difference between Coke and Pepsi. It's like, oh, like some people can really like immediately tell other branded colas are available, but because they're so similar and yet there is like a really distinct difference between them, even though you put them in the same category. And I just thought, I don't want to medicate my grief. I am very pro medication for mental illness, but I didn't want to take the edge off something that I think is an incredibly natural and necessary process. And it's only been in the past couple of weeks where I'm like, oh shit, oh I felt better, I think I'm back, guys. Which is like, of course, it's so classic in terms of how seasonally affected I am. And I was like, oh, great, I can just have the pandemic sads instead of the kind of like crucial. And I think the decision to go on medication again was like kind of compounded by lockdown, because it was like, it's literally me and my partner and he's doing everything he can to support me. So I need to do everything to support myself to do that back. And happy to say it's working. I'm very fortunate to know that I have a medication that I can rely on. I'm going to talk about that in, like, because I've told you, Anna, and I'll say it accountably, I'm going to write a book about it. I'm going to write a fucking book about it. I will. But all of that ramble to say, now that I'm well again, I feel like I can actually be in touch with my grief in a way that I wasn't before, because it was just all this kind of like flat, deep blackness, a completely infertile void. Whereas now it's like, oh, my grief can actually like expand and take space, because it's not just those moments of like, fuck, I really need my mum right now and I don't know what I'm gonna do in the next 5 minutes because I know she's not here and that's like an impossibility, to being like, oh, I remember that funny thing she said. Like, I can experience the joy of her again. And I think that's like the more, it's more holistic. So that's how it is.
I have three things to say to you before we bring on our guest. One is, welcome back.
Yay!
Number two is that you're glowing.
Oh,
yeah. And number three, it's really nice to see you happy in all seriousness, is that I wonder, I so often think with like grief and depression and the link between the two of them, like when you cannot explore your grief when you're depressed, because your body goes into survival mode, I think. And your body is like, nah, we cannot have any of that going on. Like, and I know that I push it away when I'm low. I just push it out and I'm like, that is too much right now. You cannot do that. And then when that lifts a bit and your body feels a bit stronger and your brain feels a bit stronger, it's really nice to be able to explore the bits of grief that aren't just the really sad bits. Because there are bits that aren't sad, which actually brings us quite nicely, I love a link, to our guest this week, who is a comedian and who quite famously, for me, famously, says that comedy plus tragedy, oh wait, equals comedy? No. What is it?
Shall I help you out?
Please.
tragedy plus time equals comedy is a bit of a famous saying.
Thanks, Rosie. This is Rosie Wilby. She is a comedian, a podcaster, and an author of two books. The first one is called Is Monogamy Dead? And the second one is called The Breakup Monologues, not The Breakup Monocles, as I called it when I interviewed her for my other podcast, which is called The Brighton Book Club, if anyone's interested. Welcome, Rosie.
Oh, thank you both for having me. It's lovely to be on here to talk about my lovely mum.
And we're very excited to have you. So, Rosie, can I ask, how is your grief today?
Well, I think I can sort of sound an optimistic note in a way, because it's 22 years since my mum died. And so I really wanted to come on and say it really does get better in so many ways. And it's, of course, grief is a long journey and it never really goes away 100%. But, you know, I have really been on that journey where I can think so much more about all the fun things about my mum. And I can think back to that very dramatic and chaotic time, which we'll talk about in the aftermath of mum dying and a lot of other things that happened in my life that we'll come on to. And I can sort of think, whew, you know, and sort of feel, you know, feel proud of myself for surviving and getting through it. And also, as we've perhaps touched on, getting some kind of creative work out of all of that journey and out of the rough times and the trauma, and using it to channel something more positive. So yeah, you know, I've definitely been on a long journey, and I can now think about all the fun things. Like I think I shared with you when we were emailing the other day that when my mum, who was called Geraldine Wilby, first spell checked a letter on her first ever word processor, it changed her name at the bottom to Gelatine Willy.
That's very silly. I love that.
So I enjoy now celebrating those fun things, because she had a sort of naughty and fun sense of humour and enjoyed, you know, funny things like that as well. So it's nice to have been on that journey where, you know, of course, there are times of the year, like we've recently had Mother's Day, where, of course, any of us who have lost our mums, however long or short a time it's been, we all think about them then, because there is so much a kind of thoughtless marketing, you know, about Mother's Day and mothers. And yeah, that can be really difficult. And it certainly was difficult for me in the roarer years soon after mum's death. Mother's Day was not my favourite time of year. But also, sadly for me, my birthday is a little bit kind of connected to mum's death, because she died just a couple of days before my birthday, or my 28th birthday. And that's kind of a weird time in your life anyway, when you're finally, I mean, you're probably about that now, aren't you?
Well, I'm a bit older than Anna, but I was 28 when Trude's died, so.
Oh, wow. And I think it's a really, when you're thinking about coming up towards 30 and what you want to do in life, and you're still really young, you know, and you're not really a proper grown up just yet. And it feels too young, even though, yes, you're not still an actual child, but it's such a time of transition, I think, when you are approaching 30, and that it seems like a milestone to turn 30. And it felt sad to do that without one of my parents. And I think the toughest thing about losing mum just before my birthday was, I think the saddest moment was to receive a birthday card with, you know, just one parent's name in it. And that is, you know, something that has always stayed with me. I think that change from two names to one was a very powerful moment, and sort of brings home the loss in a very, very strange way. But, you know, there have been so many lovely times when I felt connected to her again. Like my partner and I went to Bruges 2 or 3 years ago, and I remember that one of the last holidays that my mum had with my dad was an art holiday in Bruges, and I remembered that she'd said how happy she'd been there and how much she'd enjoyed it. And so I certainly, there was a moment when we were about to go up the sort of tower thing, and everyone goes up in Bruges, and the sun suddenly came out, and it was suddenly kind of became a glorious day after being a bit cloudy and overcast. And I don't know, you know, we like to think these things are signals and signs, but I had just been thinking about my mum, and then the sun came out, and it felt like, you know, I felt like, oh, if she could somehow see me and connect with me in some way, I think she would be, you know, happy with me eventually choosing a really nice partner. And I'm here with somebody really great, and she probably would approve finally of some of my life choices, actually, after not approving of some of my earlier ones.
So, Rosie, you give such like a warm sense of Geraldine / Gelatine already. And our next question, our first question, yeah, a proper question to kick us off is, how did she live?
Yeah, well, she was really interesting because whilst she was a slightly older mum, because she was 40 when she had me, and so in some ways seemed old-fashioned and behind the times in the sort of music or culture that she knew about. I mean, she did once show me she had an old Beatles 7-inch in the cupboard, which is kind of cool, but, you know, she really didn't know much about contemporary music and culture. And you know, she would try. I remember once in the 1990s, she said to me, "Oh, darling, have you heard about these Chemistry Boys?" and she meant the Chemical Brothers, of course. But the Chemistry Boys, I remember that one. And so she would try, but she was always getting things. She was full of malapropisms that were sort of deliberate, but I'm not sure, and always kind of getting things a bit wrong. But alongside that sort of ditzy kind of, you know, almost playing up being a bit old and ditzy even long before she was, she was also very progressive and very open-minded and ahead of her time in a way. And she was probably the one person who was very cool about me being a lesbian, because it was, you know, when I came out as a teenager, it's the 1980s, it was probably one of the most homophobic decades on record. We've just seen it depicted in the Channel 4 series It's a Sin. And we've seen how AIDS and HIV made everybody hate gay people at that time. And so it was a very difficult time to be thinking that I might be gay. And yeah, my mum was probably the one person who was quite embarrassingly excited and embracing of it, and started telling me all about her and her friend Joan, who used to holiday a lot together, and, oh, you know, I could have been a lesbian in a different era. And you know, you sort of don't want to hear that, really. But she was this weird contradictory kind of mix of old-fashioned values, and, you know, she didn't want me to get my ears pierced and kind of mess with my body and in kind of ways that I might not be happy with later in life. But equally, she was very, very forward-thinking and progressive about, you know, equality and feminism and gay rights. And she was a lecturer in English literature at a college of higher education. And all these students who were lesbians or who were kind of outsiders in some way would somehow, you know, see her as a bit of a role model and come and confide in her. Like, she was a woman who always wore trousers, maybe except if it was a wedding or a really special occasion. But she didn't sort of, you know, feel like she had to wear skirts and dresses and high heels and present herself. She was definitely quite a feminist and quite a feminist role model.
Did she call herself a feminist at the time?
I think she would have done, yes. Yes, I think she, I mean, I didn't really hear her say the word a lot, but, you know, she definitely enjoyed quite feminist authors, and, you know, her bookshelves were all full of kind of virago books and female authors, women writers, great women of literature. And, you know, she would have spoken about how, you know, famous women of history had to use male names and how shocking that was. So she would have definitely been, you know, definitely imbued with sort of very feminist values, even if I didn't often hear her say the word, but I think she definitely would have said that she was a feminist. Yeah.
I was just mulling on that. Sorry.
Mull away.
I just had a little memory to share of coming out to Trude's. Well, I didn't realise I was bi. I thought even at the ripe old age of like 21, I was like, you have to be one or the other. And I remember saying to her, like in tears, like, well, I think I might be gay. And she was like, oh, darling, I love you whatever you are, but you're not gay. Excuse me, mother? What? She was like, well, no, because, you know, when all of your friends were experimenting at school, you didn't. And I was like, number one, that's not how it works. And number two, who said I did? But she had what I think was quite a sort of benevolent homophobia, where she said, oh, darling, gay men are just fantastic. They're just fabulous. No, they just take you shopping and you can just complain about bad boyfriends together. So, you know what I mean? And you know, I think because my mum was definitely very much like always described herself as a feminist. But I think because she, there's something about the generation, I'm sort of fascinated about the generation that my mum belonged to, which is kind of baby boomer and then a little bit too late for the 60s and then coming up through the 80s. But like, so that sort of individualistic streak that kind of started to sort of veer feminism, possibly not the best way. But I think it was just so evident in how my mum lived that it was like a woman can do absolutely anything and everything because she did it all herself.
Or whoever they want.
Yeah.
Right. Again, I was in a little lesbian dream there.
I think we can encourage dreams of sapphic kind of musings.
My mum wasn't alive for my first gay relationship, but I always knew that she would have really liked her, probably 100% more than she liked any of the absolute fuckboys I brought home. She would have been like an independent, beautiful, kind woman who doesn't treat you like shit. This is wonderful. I think she wouldn't have cared as long as they were just good, because I have a tendency to not choose the good ones.
Did you come out to Dr. Sue, or was it something that kind of...
No, this was after she died.
Yeah.
No, I never... But you know what? And cross-referencing to my episode with my brother a couple of weeks ago, I never felt the need to come out. And I think I never felt the need to come out because I grew up in a gay household, even though it wasn't explicit to me at the time. Rosie, for reference, my dad is gay, and my mum married her gay best friend when she was in her early 30s, which is a lovely story. But I think that, and I think Seb and I talked about this recently, that there wasn't sexuality, whatever, gender roles, whatever. Like, we just, and this is so Brighton, I hate myself for saying it, but like, it was just not even almost worth talking about. My mum would always say, she'd say, I wish your brother was gay, then I'd have someone to go shopping with, because I don't like shopping. And she quite liked shopping. And that was it, really. So she'd have been just happy whoever, I'm sure. Yeah.
That's how I felt with Trude, honestly. Like, the number of people, because my parents divorced before I was particularly conscious of myself, let alone anyone else. I'm like, oh, and I was like, no, it's literally all I know. It's really weird for me to see people with their parents together, because my mum really did do everything. Moving on to our next question, Rosie. Please, could you tell us a story about Geraldine? And again, it doesn't have to be anything particularly like the apex of her. It can be something as delightful as Gelatine Willy, anything in that thread. But whatever story you feel like you want to share just now.
Well, I was thinking the other day about how it used to be really, really fun how my mum would, I think slightly deliberately in a naughty sort of way, sabotage very serious and very competitive Christmas games. So I'm an only child, and myself and my mum and dad would often go over for Christmas to my uncle's house, where my uncle Philip lived with my auntie Margaret, who very sadly has recently passed away, and my two cousins, Elizabeth and Helen. And they had a slightly more affluent lifestyle than us, a bigger house, and my auntie and uncle worked in the legal profession and became judges and sort of started earning a lot more money than my teacher parents. And so you know, everyone loved one another, and you know, there was a huge amount of love, but there was a slight cultural gap that started to appear as the years wore on. And as I became older and became a teenager, I became conscious of it. And I think my mum's sort of little act of rebellion almost against the sort of slight, I mean, it feels unkind to say show-offiness, but the sort of showiness of my uncle and auntie with their lavish Christmas dinner and their house and decorations and lavish Christmas tree and you know, my cousins having new skis and new ski boots and new ski outfits every year and all of this kind of stuff. I think her slight rebellion against that lavishness would be to deliberately mess up when we would play games. Like, there was one called Taboo, where you had a series of cards and you had a word that you had to describe without saying other very obvious words that most people would link to that word. So if it was cornflakes, you couldn't say milk or breakfast or cereal or things like that. So what she would do is give a clue that was so obscure that there's no way that her team would be able to get it. You know, there'd be my two cousins trying to understand what on earth she was talking about when she's saying, oh, I once taught a student who didn't like these. And they'd be like, what? You know, and this was all under high pressure. You turned over a sand timer and you had very, very limited time. And she would go off on this sort of long, rambling story. And we would only got through like one card to describe one word. And everyone would be like, move on. I don't understand. I don't know. And then she'd go on to the next card in the next sort of long, rambling, completely spurious clue. And I would find it really funny because I kind of knew what she was doing. Whereas my aunt and uncle and cousins just thought she was losing it, I think.
I love that. What a beautiful way to reject the idea of winning in any way. Yes. And just being like, actually, I'm going to have fun. I respect that so much.
Can I ask you a question, Rosie, and you a question, Emily? So I'm really interested in siblings and death, having a sibling and death. And I'm also interested in not having a sibling and grief and death. And I wonder if you've ever thought about the impact of being an only child, or if it has had an impact in losing your mum and your grief, really.
I think being an only child has had a huge impact on my life in all kinds of ways. And in fact, it gets mentioned in my forthcoming book, The Breakup Monologues. I talk about loneliness and different kind of different types of loneliness, and how often we can expect our partner to sort of fulfill and relieve all the axes or all the dimensions of our loneliness, when in fact they should only really be filling one of those dimensions. And so I think loneliness is incredibly complex, and I think for me, being an only child has been part of a type of loneliness for a long time. And I do think that when you lose a parent, well, if you know, it's an interesting one, isn't it? If you were close with a sibling, I think it would be a great comfort and a great help. And I'm so glad that my two cousins that I just mentioned, who I sadly don't have a huge amount of contact with anymore, but they're wonderful young women, and they're so close, and I'm so glad they have each other when I know they have recently lost their mother. And I, you know, I have sent them my well wishes, but I, as I say, I don't have tons of contact with them anymore. But I would imagine if you're close with your sibling, that would be a huge, huge comfort. Of course, many people have quite testy relationships with a sibling, and a bereavement is the thing that really brings it all out to the fore when people are talking about wills and that kind of thing. So I guess it could go either way, but something that I have noticed recently is actually sort of feeling more alone in that experience of losing a parent has been alleviated a great deal as I've got older, partly because it feels less peculiar to have lost a parent. Now, you know, I've just turned 50 and loads of people my age have lost one or possibly even both of their parents. And also my partner, who I am engaged to now, so my fiancé, I should say.
And
Suze, she lost her dad when she was in her 20s. So we have this sort of common experience of losing a parent relatively early in life. And I think that is something that really connects us, even though we don't sit around every dinner, you know, talking about, oh, what was it like to lose your mum? What was it like to lose your dad? But I think that's just something I've never felt like, certainly when I was in the relationship I was in at the time when I lost my mum, I've never felt like there were a lot of people around me in my peer group who understood what it would be like. Nobody else who was in their mid-20s could conceive, or certainly in my immediate sphere of friends, could conceive of what it would be like. They just hadn't even approached even thinking about losing one of their parents yet. And so it has been, I think, a really important thing to meet somebody who has had that experience of having one of their parents sadly pass away through illness, you know, relatively early in their life, and have had a fairly long period without that person in their lives, and also kind of, you know, had a different relationship with their remaining parent because of that. And I do want to, in this podcast, also give a shout out to my mother-in-law, Glenda, who, although nobody would ever fill the void left by your biological mother, I do think it has been a wonderful thing to have a brilliant mum-in-law. And on Mother's Day recently, Suze gave her a call and said, you know, get in the FaceTime and say happy Mother-in-Law's Day, you know. And we just have a really fun and lovely relationship, and I think that does really make you feel like you've got, you know, another mum in a way, although it's not a replacement, but it is something very precious and amazing. And I'm really glad to have had that relationship with Glenda. She's a really, really brilliant and fun woman. So I did want to give her a shout out on this podcast as well, because I think that helps a huge amount, particularly as I haven't often had relationships with partners' mums, because some partners have been closeted, and, you know, there was a whole relationship I had for 5 years where I never even met my mother-in-law, as it were. And so to have this close connection is important.
Well, hello, Glenda.
Hello, Glenda.
Let's dedicate to Glenda. And also, because Emily and I talk about this quite a lot, Rosie, and there are women in our lives that will never be our mums, that understand that and understand that boundary, but love us and are there for us. And those women are so important, and hopefully they know who they are. Emily, I'm just going to ask you about the only child thing. Like, did that resonate with you, what Rosie was saying?
So much. So I'm going to go on a classic Benita ramble here. Please excuse me. There's so much I want to say. Firstly, in terms of the women who can never replace our mothers but are with us and hold us through that loss, my wonderful friend Ruth said to me, she's like, I just see you like a Disney princess now. Like, the number of Disney princesses that are motherless. Like, that's just you. And it was just the loveliest, cutest way of me being like, oh yeah, I'm a princess. Yeah. But another thing that I noticed that a lot of Disney princesses have are some kind of maternal guidance that isn't necessarily their mother. Like, there's always a fairy godmother or something like that. And I'm like, I have a coven of brilliant women who just swoop in and are like, you know, we'll like spit on their thumb and wipe stuff on my face because I'm still a mess at 31. And big props to mother-in-laws as well. Like, so my partner David, his mum Jill is so lovely, and she lost her mum coming up to like a year ago, and I was really honoured, David, to commemorate Mother's Day in some way. Jill was like, remember, it's Mother's Day and all this. So there was this weird sort of thing between us where he was like, every so often he remember, oh yeah, it's Mother's Day, I need to do something for my mum, are you okay, do we need to do anything for you? And I was like, it's all right, I'll figure myself out. But it was really nice because I organized the flowers for Jill, and it felt like a really lovely, genuine way of enjoying it, because it is, I almost feel like it's like, where does the apostrophe fall, where does the plural of mother fall on Mother's Day? Because just because I, you know, I miss and love truths, it doesn't mean that I don't appreciate my stepmom or my godmother or my friend's mum, who was kind of like, we joke, she was a, like an extra mum that I had growing up. They're all incredible women, so props to them. And I think coming back to the only child thing, I've sometimes felt a little bit like a daughter for hire, because I had a lot of time again on my own, and Trude's worked, and I, you know, got to know a lot of her friends. And it's that weird thing where it's like, oh, there's actually so many people who are invested in looking after you in some way. And I've always believed, even though my mum did the absolute lion's share with me, it is absolutely a village that raises a child. And I like to think that I'm not like the sort of nightmare stereotype of an only child. But when it comes to my mum, I'm like, she's mine. No one else is. So I was like, oh yeah, no, it's just me. And what you were saying about relationships as well there, Rosie, like, oh my god, like it's in my relationship with David, where I've had very similar breakthroughs along the same lines that you have, Anna, where I'm like, oh my god, yeah, I was in a long-term relationship with my mum because it was just the two of us. It wasn't even like I had necessarily a relationship to model on. It was like, no, it was us. We looked after each other. And my mum was very much boss. She wasn't one of those mums who was like, you know, I'm not a regular mum, I'm a cool mum. Like, you're my best friend. She's like, I am your parent and this is the law and I love you. Stop being a twat. She wouldn't have called me a twat, but I got the feeling. And I've realised in my relationships, it's like, are you my mum or am I my mum? Yeah. Trying to learn to sort of chill out. And be like, maybe no one has to be your mum.
Yeah. And it's like, am I mumming myself well enough at the moment? And then realizing that, no, you can't, like, yeah, it's a lot. So actually, this brings us perfectly onto our next question, Rosie, because I want to talk about this in relation to what you've written in your book as well. What worked and what didn't? Tell us about the impact that the death of your mum when you were young had on your romantic relationships.
Well, yeah, this is a really interesting question, because I think what worked for me was, to some extent, channeling all that weird kind of grief energy and stress into creativity for a little while. I was still a musician when my mum died. I hadn't yet started doing comedy and writing books, but I was a singer-songwriter, and I actually, in some ways, the death of my mum triggered me actually wanting to document my music in some way, and I recorded my one and only ever album that I released, which you can still find if you should want to. It's very old now, but it is out there on Spotify and iTunes and whatnot. But I actually recorded that and wanted to put some songs down, because I think, you know, a death makes you realise that life is short, and that if you are creating something rather than just going around playing gigs and sort of waiting for someone to discover you, you actually want to make it real and put it down, either put it down on paper if it's a book, or you know, put it down on CD or cassette or whatever the medium was then. It was released as a CD. And so I think that was important. I guess you do sometimes have a burnout if you channel a lot of energy into creativity. But that was definitely something that was going on, was this sort of creative energy. But also, you know, what I would say what didn't work is, if you can possibly try not to have a breakup in the immediate aftermath of the bereavement.
Because I felt a certain amount of confusion at untangling the different strands of grief and knowing which thing, which bereavement, which loss I was actually grieving, because I suppose I felt some kind of guilt that I should be grieving most for my mum, because that was a person that was actually dead. Whereas I think the more immediate pain and distress that I felt might have been more connected to the loss of the relationship, because that felt more of a shock. It felt like something where the ground had been taken from under me, and I was like a tree uprooted, because this wasn't something I'd been expecting, in the same way that I was kind of in some sense able to prepare for my mum's death because she had cancer. And rationally, we know that many, many people die when they have cancer, and particularly when, like my mum, if they decide to stop having treatment. So I felt very confused about these different strands of grief. And I think if you can really try and communicate with your partner at that time and just say, I'm probably going to be a nightmare for a year at absolute minimum. You know, I'm going to be chaotic. I'm going to be all over the place. Can we just, you know, try not to make any rash decisions about breaking up at the moment? And I mean, it was probably sort of my decision in the end, but it's one I sort of regret, because even though we would have broken up anyway, we had a good friendship underpinning that romantic relationship, and we were able to preserve that eventually. But we broke up at such a chaotic time in my life that it did get dramatic for a while and a bit spiky, and literally to the point of, I actually, the only time I've ever had some kind of a fight with the person that she had started seeing.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh.
And this woman, right, because she was a bit of a player, she'd also slept with me and then went and slept with my girlfriend. She was playing some weird game. And I was like, what are you doing? And so I ended up, this woman was twice my size. She was massive. And she did that thing where I sort of kind of pushed her in not a very effective way, but she did this dramatic fall down onto the pavement as if like, oh my God, you know, Rosie Wilby is trying to kill me. And so it's all, oh God, the police were called, and I was barred from this venue where we were fighting outside for like a year. And I had to write a letter to the manager and say, I'm ever so sorry that I had a fight outside your establishment, to be able to get let back in. And it was kind of ridiculous, but it was such a chaotic and dramatic time, because the other loss that happened in this sort of very chaotic period in my life was in between my mum dying and my relationship breaking up. Me and my partner had a fire in our home where we lost most of our stuff. And so, of course, there was a real sense of, why is all this stuff happening to me? What on earth? How do I regain some kind of control of my life? And so the flat where myself and my partner used to have all these kind of fun parties and fun times, one day we got back from our respective jobs, and we'd actually both been singing together on BBC London, singing a lovely love song called You Amaze Me, which was one of my favourites from the album. And we'd had this lovely evening where we'd been in the radio studio with the presenter Amy LeMay, who is now London's Night Tsar, and she'd had loads of people calling in. And Amy had loads of people calling in saying, who is this singing? This is gorgeous. I love this song. And we were on a bit of a high. We were walking along our road. It was Upper Tollington Park in Finsbury Park. And we got this strange sense as we rounded the corner to our drive. Our neighbour was standing in the doorway of our communal building, and our flat was the basement flat. And he was saying, I'm really sorry. There's been a terrible accident was the word he used, which seemed really odd. And yeah, all our flat was kind of boarded up by the fire brigade with a tiny little post-it note saying, see you in the morning. Because they were, we had no house to go into, no home, no flat, and just a post-it note from the fire brigade saying they'd come and kind of show us what on earth had happened to our home the next day. And so I was really in free fall and chaos. We phoned a friend and kind of stayed with a friend for a few nights. And this, as you can imagine, did put a lot of pressure on our relationship. And we, it's perhaps no wonder we broke up after all this stuff was going on. And we, spent a few weeks kind of sorting through all our burned belongings in our blackened out flat. What was like this kind of, all the windows were blacked out and the all the kind of pictures we'd had on the walls and stuff were all melted down the walls, and my guitars, because of course I was doing music then, my guitars were kind of fine at the bottom because heat rises, so things that were low down near the floor were okay, but the guitars that were on stands had sort of melted into these strange weird shapes at the top where they kind of melted over and then were hanging down in like sort of stalactites, and the keys on my keyboard were all hanging down like icicles that had just kind of melted down like this weird cheese. And so it was a very, very raw and odd time where one loss was very quickly compounded with another and then compounded with another. And to some extent, the all our belongings being so ruined by the fire was a sort of visual representation of that. I remember sort of taking photos of the musical instruments, and I thought about doing an EP at the time called Damaged Goods, because that's how you feel you are when you're going through all these stages of losses. And I think bereavement does plunge us into a sort of chaos. So if there's anything we can do to avoid having other losses to deal with as well, I think that would probably be good, because looking back, I don't quite know how I got through that time at the end of my 20s, but I did and survived it and, you know, have, like I say, used a lot of those experiences to sort of channel some kind of creativity. But they were also exhausting and draining and I'm sure quite scarring in a way, because you do feel like, oh God, you know, life is very, very hard suddenly.
Yeah, I was just casting myself back and realizing like, oh yeah, I got dumped like about three weeks to a month after my mum's funeral. I got like, again, really focused on it and really heartbroken. And I think it's because that was the loss I knew. It was not the first time I'd been dumped. And it was so much easier and cleaner. And actually, I love that term from Emma Jane as well. I'm definitely going to go forward with it. That fertile void. I was like, oh, wait, here's something. I'm just going to like reinvent myself or whatever. And underneath it was like, you're ignoring the real pain with this fancy pain on top. It's normally, there's jingles. It's a lot of jingles.
Isn't it so funny? I was single when, there's a lot of jingles. I was single when my mum died, and my best friend in the whole entire universe, Hannah, and I could do a whole episode about how to deal with a best mate that's grieving with Hannah, because she was amazing. And she was meant to go on holiday with some of her other, I know she has other friends, with her other friends. And she just messaged me. She said, I can't get on that plane. I'm coming down to Brighton. And she came down to Brighton and she followed me around the whole city organising my mum's funeral. And she said to me, if you had a boyfriend, he'd be here. He'd probably be useless, but he'd be here. But instead, I'm here. And then in the evening, we'd go to the pub, and during the day, we'd plan the funeral. And I will never forget that kindness. My other best mate, Joe, was living in Sheffield at the time, and his parents lived around the corner from me. We've known each other since we were four. And he came out, he was like, just to let you know, I'm in Brighton when you need me. And I do need him in the evening, occasionally, you know, for a spliff or a drink or whatever we were doing at the time. Like, we're not still doing that. But just after my mum died, I started sleeping with my ex-boyfriend, who I had been with when I was 16 to when I was 18. And he was the last boyfriend that my mum knew that I had. And I remember just this such an irrational thought, just thinking, I have to end up with this man because she knew him and she loved him. It has to be him, because otherwise she'll never meet the person they end up with. And he, bless him, very kindly in the end was like, listen, babe, come on, we can't really do this, can we? Like, it's not really healthy. And I was like, I know, but it just makes so much sense. And he was like, it doesn't, though. It doesn't. I mean, he's an absolute legend. Like, what a babe for doing that, because it could have just gone on for however long. That I remember this time thinking, I've lost the love of my life. Who, thanks to him, I hadn't thought about for a couple of years, you know what I mean? Lost the love of my life, I've lost my mum, like I have nothing. And it's so funny how you can use those romantic relationships to attribute to your grief, because it's escapism.
And like, of course you want to escape it, and
something that I'm going to repeat here because I've been saying a bit and other people are saying it's helpful, and I think I mentioned it on a previous episode, but anyway, I'm going to get to the point, is that I think so often we're possibly a bit too concerned with the idea of grieving healthily, which I think can be usurped by like wellness and all of this stuff. Whereas really, I think the key thing is like, are you at risk? Because that's something that is like dangerous, because grief is very hard to do, let alone figure out how to do it healthily, particularly in the beginning. And like, and I do think it is a real kind of like, when it rains, it pours, like thinking back to the sort of run up to my mum dying and just after, there was an awful lot of other stuff going on as well, and it can definitely feel like, what am I, Job right now? Like, why is it all happening now? But I think it is just because, you know, my mum was the absolute, like, and still is, like, the core and foundation of my world and myself. So of course everything's gonna like spin out from that. It's not, you know, intentional. But yeah, I think as long as you're not putting yourself at risk, you can, this is the time that you can be a wee bit unhealthy. And bless him for saying, like, I know what this is. You might know, not realise what this is, but I'd...
I am using you, but please let me.
So I haven't come up with as beautiful a segue as you have throughout this episode, Anna, so apologies, but we've come now.
It's impossible.
it was too good. So we come to our final question. That's as far as I can get. Rosie, what would you like to tell us in terms of an answer to a question that we haven't asked you? What do you really want to get across about Geraldine, about your grief, all of it?
Well, I thought I'd be interested just to talk about how we are given permission to talk about grief, which I think is altering. There are obviously podcasts like Griefcast now, and there is more discussion about grief. But I think what's interesting as well is how performers and creatives are allowed to discuss grief, and how there has been, I believe, a difference in how male and female performers have been allowed to talk about grief. I'm a comedian and obviously been going to Edinburgh Fringe for a number of years. I mean, I kind of don't do that anymore for reasons that I lay out in the book, and how I believe it has ceased being an open access arts festival, but you can read all about my thoughts about that.
I look forward to reading it, Rosie, but I also agree. I just wanted to interject.
But I think for a long time, it feels like there's been a trope of kind of dead dad shows done by male comedians, and they always get kind of 5 stars and accolades, and like, oh, all the male critics kind of going, oh, he was so brave and so vulnerable. Whereas I, 1 year, did a show that was a much more sensitive storytelling show with a bit of my old music in it, where there was a bit where I'd take the mood right down and talk about losing my mum. And I sing a song called Take My Hand, which was a song that I wrote with my mum. Well, actually co-wrote with my girlfriend Donna from, you know, that time in my life, because I was singing the verse, mother, are the demons here to fill my life with, to fill my heart with blood and life and fear, or something. The words just slightly change every verse, but you can still hear my album online. And she just came in the room and sang Take My Hand, which was just became the chorus. But anyway, I decided to sing this song in this show, and that's very clearly not that there are comic moments in the show. It was about my music career and sort of kind of failed, in inverted commas, music career. I mean, I actually think there were a lot of things that I did that you could claim as successes, but I sort of was, you know, in that sense that comedians do lampooning myself. But there was this moment in the show where I really, you know, did something raw and vulnerable. But I feel like because I was the woman doing it, and this is, you know, 10 years ago, before we've had kind of women like Hannah Gadsby doing her Nanette show, which has been much more somber and serious and challenging, there was still a sense that if a woman wasn't doing a show that was wall-to-wall punchlines and gags and isn't life funny and yay, then people are just like, oh, women aren't very funny. You know, they just want to talk about emotions and feelings and dead mums and whatever. I mean, at periods, yeah. I mean, obviously that I'm slightly generalising, but I felt there was a bit of a sense of it was quite difficult as a woman to be taken seriously talking about something serious in an equivalent way that a male comedian might be very heralded for talking about something quite emotional and deep. So that was something that I guess I wanted to share, because I found that when I started trying to do more serious comedy shows, I got quite shit reviews for a while, actually.
I'm just watching Emily be validated live on camera right now.
Oh my God, Rosie, thank you so much. I'm so grateful to you for bringing this up, because I think it's really hard to work in comedy and want to make it better as an arena in so many different ways, as an artistic discipline. And again, this is shot through for women everywhere in any kind of sector. As soon as you speak up, it's like you're complaining. I feel so much of this, and it's really difficult. And I think it's interesting that you mentioned Hannah Gadsby in particular, because she won the Edinburgh Award, and it was the first year that it was a joint award with John Robbins and his breakup show, The Darkness of Robbins. And Sarah Pascoe had her breakup show about them the same year and was incredibly funny and really self-deprecating. And John Robbins did a good show, but was a lot darker and a lot more kind of like exposing all of his vulnerability and this kind of stuff. They were put on at pretty much the same time in different venues in the Pleasance Courtyard, which I thought was a very interesting marketing ploy. Anyway.
Whose side are you on?
Exactly. It was like pick a side, particularly if you're only at the Fringe for a day. But, you know, because I was there for a while, I'm sort of. Emily, get back to your point. And I think I find that really difficult because, and I think it's going to be a decision that people will look back at and be like, this is kind of an interesting decision that you had, like, literally a watershed moment in comedy and admittedly a very good but still like a breakup show. And I do think it's this complicated murkiness where it's like there is no way of getting around that suicide is still the like biggest killer of a huge demographic of men in the UK in terms of emotions and connection. Men are, I can't think of a better way of putting it than at the moment, really quite fucked. And I want to change that. And so I think these comedians are really important in terms of like bringing up the conversation. Like I think Russell Cain does a really good job as well. But because we still live in patriarchy, they are rewarded more for that than for women who are socialized to necessarily be more emotional or emotional at all. It's like, well, that's just how you are. And also, could you stop banging on about it? The other thing about, I wanted to sort of make a very quick comment about the prevalence of dead dad, mortal mum, perishable parents shows at the Fringe. And it comes back to your point about it being not really an open access arts festival, because I think the trajectory of the Fringe becoming a very stressful, expensive month-long audition to be commissioned to put on TV has also matched with the proliferation of these shows. And my feeling is like, well, just from my own experience, and I wonder if this is the same for a lot of other people, I was only able to do my first Fringe show because I had my inheritance from my mum, and it kind of became my unofficial grant. I wouldn't be able to get arts funding. I fucking tried. But and I was like, well, and this is the major thing that's happened to me. I actually finally have something to say beyond, oh, pugs, their little faces, which was a lot of my material. It's like, you know, I think people were just relieved not to hear about Brexit for an hour as well. And I also think it's a real shame that there is that kind of feeling around it now, because it's like, sorry everyone, but like, you know, death is going to happen to all of us, and if we're going to talk about the conversation about grief more, because I think it's slightly derogatory, isn't it, the sort of like, it's a dead dad show. It's like, no, that's that person's dead dad.
Oh yeah, yeah. Of course,
yeah. You know, and because I wouldn't know exactly how you're using that term, but I think overall in the industry it's seen as kind of like a little bit dismissive, when if anything it should be like, oh, it's great that we're talking about this more. Can you tell that I miss comedy and have a complicated relationship with it? Or was I just too subtle?
Yeah, that wasn't very subtle.
I put the B in.
Well, I love you. Rosie, thank you so much for joining us tonight. How can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of your wonderful book?
Oh, you got it right. I'm on Twitter at Rosie Willby. And I'm on Instagram at Breakup Monologues. And the book is available to pre-order from all good bookshops. It comes out at the end of May, so not too long to wait now. And so, yeah, and obviously you can listen to the Breakup Monologues podcast as well on all your favourite podcast places.
Thank you very much. You're an absolute dream.
Thank you for listening to the Mother of All Losses podcast.
This episode was produced by Chris Thorburn. Music by Kane Aris, who can be found at Atom Collection 2 on SoundCloud, with huge thanks to Hannah Trevathan.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us on themotherofalllosses@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Until next time, take care of yourselves and your grief.